This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, sitting in for Terry Gross. Otis Taylor's new CD opens with the sound of a train and a blues line that sets the tone for a recording critics describe as intense, unsettling, powerful, and uncompromising. Otis Taylor learned to play the ukulele, banjo, and guitar as a kid in Denver, Colorado, played in several blues and rock and roll bands, and then quit the music business in 1977. For 20 years, he worked as an antiques broker and appraiser before deciding to get back up on stage. White African is his third CD to be released in this second phase of Taylor's career. The opening track is My Soul's in Louisiana.
Well, my soul, Louisiana, but my body lies in Tennessee. I didn't kill no brakeman. I didn't kill no engineer. Well, a white man pointed his finger and they said what they always say. They didn't bother to hang me. They just shot me on the spot.
My Soul's in Louisiana, from Otis Taylor's new CD, White African. Otis Taylor joins us from Boulder, Colorado. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Tell us about that song. Where is that story from?
Well, the idea was when I was a little kid, I hitchhiked in 64 to the Berkeley Folk Festival, but I had to go ask my father if I could hitchhike, and he told me that he used to ride the rails, you know. He used to hobo, and he worked for the Pullman, so I was sort of surprised because he's kind of really... surprised he did that. So I just thought about the Hillsboro's boys and things that happened in the South, and whether it was white or black, about hobos and how they kind of got in a lot of trouble. When I was a little kid, I used to look for hobo camps at the Platte River. So I think I had this hobo thing in my head most of my life. So I just sort of write about a black hobo.
In the liner notes of your new CD, there are 12 pictures of black men, and underneath them, the legend, wrong place, wrong time. What does that mean?
Oh, well, I just collect things. I collect photographs of blacks in the West. I was at a gun show once and looking for American Indian art, and I saw these photographs of these criminals and or people that are arrested, or I wouldn't say people arrested. And so I brought the whole collection of all the blacks and a few women and other people of color, and I got them home and I started reading the back of them. And it kept on saying, arrested, vagrancy, released, arrested, vagrant. And so all those people were arrested and released. So they're just being hassled in the 30s, you know, the late 20s and the 30s. And I thought it was sort of interesting. And so it's just sort of part of that kind of history.
There's one other picture, though, with the same legend, wrong place, wrong time.
Yeah, that was my uncle, Andrew Bell. He was a, you know, he lived a, you know, he ran the streets, as we say, in the ghetto, you know, and he was a, they were robbing a crap game, and he got shot. They said, give him the money. He said no, and I guess he miscalculated something, and he was killed. Wrong place, wrong time, you know. That, part of that history, you know.
On this CD, we already heard some of the song about the guy who got shot for nothing. There's a song about suffering, another about a man trying not to cry when his mother's sick, another about a homeless man whose child is sick and dying, a song about lynching, and a song about hunger. That's a lot of bleak material there.
Is that bleak? I mean, you know, I remember going to see the movie Midnight Cowboy, and I got so depressed. Mm-hmm. I mean, why all of a sudden if I write a couple sad songs, or I went to see Songcatcher last night, nobody's, you know, I don't know. I think blues got a little party oriented, and so I'm kind of taking it back to maybe where it should be, or maybe people should think about that. I don't know. I don't think myself is so bleak. I mean, if you listen to Cloak and Dagger songs of the Appalachian people sing, those are pretty bleak songs too.
Hmm.
So I don't know why I'm getting the bleak rap, but that's the way it is.
I wonder if somebody in your record company or your producer said, you know, hey, you mind if we want to lighten this up a little bit, just a little
bit? Oh, he did. My producer, he positively did. He actually positively said, Otis, all these songs are depressing. I go, well, let's do the first three depressing songs first and just crucify them. Let's just go for it. I mean, this is what I do, this is what I'm doing, and I'm happy with this, so let's not try to cover it up, you know? And it worked. It was very successful, luckily. But he did argue with me.
Producers generally win those arguments.
He's my best friend. That helps. He's the one who rediscovered me. Kenny Passarelli, he's my producer, and we're good friends, and that's why we work together as a team.
You grew up in Denver, and that is not a place that immediately leaps to mind as, you know, the birthplace of the blues.
No, no. I was born in Chicago, and my parents are from, my father's from Memphis, my mother's from Lake Providence. I'm like what you call first-generation Southern, like an immigrant, you know, when people migrated to Chicago, you know, some part of that great migration, sort of.
How old were you when you first got interested in music?
I was 14 and a half. Well, I always liked music, but I got my banjo, my first banjo when I was 14 and a half at the Denver Folklore Center.
Now, you live nearby that?
Yeah, about five blocks away, yeah.
And you used to go over there and hang out?
Hang out. I lived there. After school, on the weekends, you know. A lot of kids lived there. It was a beautiful place. It was a beautiful time in history during that sort of folk, early folk time, you know, before psychedelic, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And you would, what, ask people to teach you stuff?
Yeah, I learned how to play for free. I just bummed lessons in between the teacher's classes. And that was a pain in the you-know-what, but they did it, and look at what happened. So it was beautiful, you know, and I really appreciate it.
What kind of music were you playing then?
I was playing old-timey banjo, Appalachian-style banjo. And you're talking about the story where I went to a party, and my banjo teacher, Mike Kropp, they took me to a party where the Dillards were at, And I play banjo. They go, hey, you're really good. You can really play. You should go down. This is like 1964, maybe 65. They said, you should go down south to those banjo contests. And I said, what'd you say? And I thought, thinking, down south, they're lynching people, killing black people. Then I said, I don't want to play the banjo that much. I said, I think I want to back off and play harmonica more or something. I got freaked out. And the sad part about it, you know, like until 9 years ago, I didn't even know the banjo came from Africa, which is really sad because I was like freaking out over something that was part of my heritage, which was really a heartbreak when you think about it.
It's almost, given the stereotypes, it's almost daring for a black man to play the banjo.
Well, yeah, but isn't that sad, you know? it's a black instrument, and you know, Taj Mahal still plays. Alvin Youngblood's an incredible banjo player. Mm-hmm. John Jackson plays a banjo, and the guitar tunings are banjo tunings, you know, your Delta guitar. They're open tunings. That's what the banjo is, you know? And so it's the whole thing, the blues to me came from the banjo styles.
You once said a fascinating thing about the styles that you learned as you grew up and as you progressed as a musician. You've been kind enough to bring your banjo into the studio with you there. And I was wondering if you could show us and describe for us what you're doing, the different styles that you learned and as you progressed to a style that's all your own.
Okay, sure. We'll try to. I've never done a workshop on this exactly.
Okay.
Sort of, yeah, but I'll try to. Like, say if you're frailing, that's going to be a very traditional. That's your sort of frailing style.
And that's the style that you would have first learned for the Appalachian style.
Yeah. Then you're picking sort of. Finger picking, and then my style is the same style I play guitar. Was the same style when I was playing banjo. When I play guitar, people say I used to play a guitar like a banjo, even when I was playing guitar.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't thinking about it. I just. Style, but I play the same style on guitar too. See,
on your new CD, White African, you do one song with the acoustic banjo, "Mama, Don't You Do It." Could you play it for us?
Yeah. Mama, don't you do it? Mama, don't you die? Mama, don't you do it? Don't make me cry. Don't want to cry.
My guest is Otis Taylor. His new CD is White African. And I have to ask you, you come up with some of the great record titles I've ever heard. It's not only Blue-Eyed Monster was your first comeback album, and then When Negroes Walk the Earth, and now White African. There's a lot of thought go into those?
No, and yeah. I just sort of, they come to me, you know? I had this blue eye thing going, but I wanted to stay away from Frank Sinatra. So I had to get something with the blue eyes and stay away from, you know? So like, no, seriously, I'm not joking now.
I'm serious.
And I wanted to, but you can laugh if you want, but I just want you to know, I was thinking, hey, I got the blue eye, I got blue. See, I have blue eyes, by the way. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah. So I was trying to, but stay away from that sort of Frank Sinatra thing. So I came up with the monster thing, you know? And then When Negroes Walk the Earth, the original Negroes Walk the Earth was going to be High Desert Negro.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay, but it's not kicking it. It's not kicking it. And I just sort of play with it, and bam, then it came through. Then White African was just sort of started off as White African. But a lot of people told me after When Negroes Walk the Earth, they said I couldn't come up with a title as good as that. So I decided I'd take the challenge. I wasn't going to let them say that to me. And I'm happy with White African.
When you grew up in Denver, Colorado, did you listen to a lot of blues records? Were you a student?
No. My father was a big, big jazz friend. He was a bebopper. He hung out with the jazz people. He worked for the railroad, so he was their best friends, you know what I mean? And he'd go across the country as a Pullman. He'd be in San Francisco one day, and 3 days later be in New York. And he just would go all the festivals and hang out at the jazz clubs. And when I was home, a kid, people they have a lot of parties, and I couldn't sleep at night because they're making so much noise. And so they were like, I'm like second generation hip, you know what I mean? But one day my mother got this Etta James thing, Can't Judge a Book by the Cover, All I Want to Do is Make Love to You, whatever it was, that big hit.
Mm-hmm.
And they played it for about 8 hours, and I really got into that, you know? I think that's when it was starting. And I remember when the Rolling Stones first did it, I didn't like their version. So I was already getting ideas about what I liked and didn't like when I was a kid about commercialism, you know?
Well, was there a moment, though, when you decided to become a musician?
Yeah, when I found out they like girls, I decided, yeah, this works. I could do this. I'm serious. You think I'm joking.
I think you're dead serious. Yeah. Now, this was the late 60s. What kind of bands were you playing in then?
The first band I had was called the Butterscotch Fire Department.
Yes, it was the late 60s, wasn't it?
Yeah, positively. Our first gig, which I thought was interesting, was the Mr. Colorado Bodybuilding Pageant. That was like a trip, man. That was. I wish I could make a movie about that. That was a trip, you know.
So you're playing psychedelic rock and roll at that point?
No, still traditional kind of rock and roll blues. Still not so psychedelic. I never got too psychedelic ever, in a sense, you know. That's why Kenny came back and got me, because he said I was the least commercial, the more sort of into the roots of it all, you know. I still like Hendrix songs, and I used to like Arthur Lee Love. I used to like their stuff a little bit, but I was pretty into Hollywood from Muddy Waters and things like that, you know. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Now, in 1969, it looked for a little while like you might become a star.
Yeah, but it got messed up. I was with Blue Horizon Records, which did like a, you know, the original Fleetwood Mac and Johnny Signs. But I was living in London, and I signed something when I was 19. Actually, my father had to sign it.
A record contract.
Yeah, and they gave me no money, no nothing. And I said, well, I need some money to live. I go, well, you don't do that. I said, okay, bye. You know, I just left. I didn't care, you know. I'm that kind of person. I guess I'm just not kind of live life on my own terms. That's why I could quit music for 20 years, you know.
Well, tell me about that. Why and when did you decide to leave the music business?
Well, at that time, I was playing bass in a band called Zephyr, and they were good friends, and we kind of had a fight, and it got close to getting physical. And I said, if I got to get physical, I don't want to do this anymore. And about 2 months later, the couple that I played with got divorced, so they're just going through some hard times, you know. Now she passed away. I'm still good friends with David, but I just said, I don't need this. I didn't need it. I don't think one should need anything, you know, when it comes to art. I don't want to be an art victim, so I just walked away, you know. But I play music at home. See, people think if you don't play in public, they think you stop music completely. You know what I mean? They kind of get that confused.
One of the things that jumps out, though, in your biography is the blues man who was an antiques broker.
Yeah, that's okay. Whatever.
No, it just seems, you know, just a little odd juxtaposition there.
Oh, I know a lot of guys who are antique brokers who played music, and you'd be surprised. Because antique brokers are like high-class collectors. They collect, and then when the collecting gets too expensive, they start buying and selling. That's how it kind of, they become antique dealers. They just want to afford their habit. You know what I mean?
Is that how it started with you?
I think for a lot of dealers, you know, what they were just like to collect.
What were you collecting?
American Indian art, you know, ethnographic art.
And at what point did it get too expensive?
It got too expensive when I was able to sell it and buy a house in Boulder,
mm-hmm.
which I've lived off for the rest of my life, you know. So that's when it got too expensive, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It was time to sell.
Now, when did you decide, as I understand, it was no great, you know, instant light bulb epiphany going off over your head to get back into the music business. You'd been playing all along.
Yeah, well, it was an accident. I had a friend named Buck Buchanan, had these stores called Buccaneer Stores, women's stores, and I was involved with bicycle racing in the 80s for about 5 years. I had two kids on the national team, third best team in the nation. And he was our main sponsor. I was a co-sponsor. And, you know, then he had these businesses that kind of went belly up, and he went Chapter 13. So he opened up a coffee house. And I guess, you know, Judy Rodgers played there and Judy Collins. And it was, you know, he sort of reopened this coffee house. And he asked me about getting equipment for PA because he knew I knew about music. And I said, Buck, I'll call some friends and we'll come down and play for you. And I ain't played in 20 years, but I will play music for you, Buck. And we did, and it sounded so good, we just kept on going. It was a fluke. It was just a fluke, and I hadn't really thought about it.
But I assume that, you know, the headlines were not, he's back. I mean, this was not the comeback
no.
of Michael Jordan or something like that. I mean, this was no. a difficult trail that you were starting out on.
Yeah, yeah. I had a friend who has a record shop called Twist and Shout in Denver, and he always said I was obscure when I was young, and then I was obscure again, I'll probably be obscure again. I'm always going to be obscure because I'm not that commercial, you know. I don't think so. Maybe I will be. Maybe people will catch up with me or something, but I'm not really that commercial. But if you want to buy my record, please do that. Let me stop you. But you know what I'm saying, don't you?
Sure.
You know? Yeah.
You've got your banjo there. Is there something you'd like to play for us?
What do you want to hear? One of my songs? You want to hear? What do you want to hear?
Why don't we hear one of your songs?
One of my songs? Okay, give me a sec. Okay, I'm going to write a song for you guys, okay? This is my dedication to you guys taking the time to do this for me. So you have to give me like a word or two words and I'll write a song about it. I can do this, man. Trust me.
Window.
Window. Oh, that's so easy. Maybe. To Mexico.
Window Blues by Otis Taylor. We'll continue with Otis Taylor in the second half of the show. I'm Neil Conan, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's hear more of our conversation with blues artist Otis Taylor, who's back after 20 years away from the music business. His new CD is White African, and he performs at blues and folk festivals around the country. You also teach blues.
Yeah, I do. I do. No, I don't. I don't call it teaching blues. I just try to turn kids on to the conceptual thought of blues. I do a thing that my wife, Carol Taylor, thought of. It's called Writing the Blues Program, and we take it into schools and colleges and universities, and have a thing. I get the blues win, then they fill out what makes them sad, so then they can think how the slaves felt when they're working in the fields, trying to get through the day. So I try to get them teach the emotion of the blues to people, not so much the technical part, you know, just the emotion.
What kind of stuff do the students come up with?
Oh, I was in Ottawa. We did a school, and there was a lot of refugees from Somalia and Kosovo. And every other kid said, well, my uncle died, well, my cousin died. And then this one kid comes up and goes, well, when I couldn't have my Matendo. And I'm thinking, whoa, this got light all of a sudden. And then it hit me that his parents were divorced, and he can only have one Matendo at one house when he goes to visit. It came to me what he was really trying to say, and that was pretty deep. But they say, you know, their parents go to jail or just all kinds of bizarre things sometimes, you know, because they're kids. But then I have adults say bizarre things, too. I've had adults literally cry when they're doing their sessions with me, too. So it's pretty deep. It's pretty intense.
You have kids of your own.
Yeah. My oldest daughter sings on the album, Cassie Taylor.
I wondered whether part of your decision about making a comeback in music, whether that involved your kids and your decision that you wanted to speak to them to some degree.
Well, I think what I wanted to do is leave some kind of legacy about who I was a long time ago. Because when I married my wife, she had no idea. She knew I had instruments around the house I played, but she didn't think I was. I was involved in bicycle racing. She said she would marry me if I quit bicycle racing, so I did quit it. And then I snuck up on her 10 years later and started this music thing. So she wasn't prepared for it. And I just wanted to kind of leave a legacy of who I was to my kids, maybe more so. I really sincerely felt that. And that's what Kenny told me. And Harry Tufte of the Folklore Center said, if I don't do it now, I wouldn't get it done. And so I went for it.
There is one song on your CD, White African, that is particularly personal, the St. Martha Blues. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it all started, my mother's very closed off about the South, and they don't talk about it much. My father talked about it a little bit, but they really didn't talk about it much, and I think it's like Vietnam syndrome. You go through certain things, and you just don't really want to talk about it. And I think if you track enough black families, that 50% of them have relatives that were lynched, you know, during those time periods. And people don't talk about it much, and I was trying to find out about the Native American Indian blood we had in our family, and so I had to call my mom up and start talking about this. And I was a little confused because we have a step-grandfather and a real grandfather, and it sort of got very confusing. And so the stories start coming out about, well, you know, your great-grandfather got, you know, lynched. And so I kind of, that all came together. But the true story about the lynching was, is my grandfather, he was ordained by Nat King Cole's father. And when he got his church, he named her the greatest St. Martha, and that's why he wrote the song, because he loved his mother so much he didn't name it after a religious figure. He named it after his mother, and I thought that was really interesting.
Otis Taylor, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
We'll end by listening to St. Martha Blues from Otis Taylor's new CD, White African.
My great-grandfather, back in Lake Providence, Louisiana, he was lynched. Not only was he lynched, they took his body and they tore it apart and they went to his wife, Martha Jones, and told her where she could find her husband. Martha, poor Martha, poor Martha Jones. She got to go downtown. Oh, she got to go. She got to go and find a husband. They came to the door. They took him away. hung them from. They hung them from the highest tree. They tore his poor body. They tore his poor body apart. Oh, they tore. They tore his poor body. They tore his poor body apart.
Otis Taylor, his new CD is White African. Coming up, America's first black paratroopers, the Triple Nickels. This is Fresh Air.